Hello, this is the podcast for our class on December 1st, and it was class number 27. We're continuing talking about intentional torts and now finally getting into the exact causes of action that comprise the intentional torts we're learning about. There are plenty other intentional torts, but the ones that we're discussing in this class and that I'm holding you responsible for are assault, battery, false imprisonment, and intentional infliction of emotional distress. And they're all really quite different. But the commonality that they have is there, that they look at the behavior of the defendant and the fact that we're trying to discourage antisocial behavior and protect mental and bodily integrity of the plaintiffs. These are all really old torts. You can see a lot of old cases that we're reading now. The difference between intentional torts and negligence. Negligence, we like some risk. Intent, we don't want this intent, substantial purpose or substantial certainty for the consequences. We don't want that. So intentional torts are less likely to have limitations on liability than in our negligence torts. Of course, you need causation and proximate cause for liability, but proximate cause is less likely to be limited by things that we might say are unforeseeable, by consequences that are unforeseeable. So anyway, starting with assault and battery, we looked at the Picard case, and Picard focused on both of these torts. Battery needs a touching, unconsented, harmful, or offensive touching. Assault just needs reasonable apprehension of a contact, the sort of which that if it occurred would be a battery. So if somebody was afraid, you know, fearful, menaced by someone, and there was an actual physical contact, you could be responsible for both assault and battery. Doesn't need both of them, but very frequently they go together. The question with Picard, there was actions on the part of the defendant, shaking his finger, a little menacing. Court said not even remotely a problem for liability for assault. The battery, though, was a different question because she said he touched her. He says, no, I just touched her camera. I wanted to grab the camera away from her. And the court said, under certain circumstances, if it's touching possessions, if those possessions are so associated with the body, such as clothes, your gloves, your hat, your cane, things that you are holding, particularly maybe holding up to your face or your head, things that you're holding, you can be held responsible for those things as a battery. So again, the idea isn't that we're trying to protect somebody's cameras or their clothes or their things. The idea is that we don't want antisocial behavior. We don't want people grabbing things. We don't want threatening, menacing. So the court uses in some ways, I mean, this isn't strict liability. It requires intent or substantial certainty, but we're sort of strict in how it's applied, because we want to eliminate harmful or offensive contact. Doesn't have to be harmful. If it doesn't injure you in some way, then it's contact that's offensive. And here she was afraid, and it was deliberate, his actions. He meant to reach for the camera. He meant to grab the camera away from her. So the court here said offensive. She has the camera. She was holding it close up to her eye. We don't know, but a jury could find this was offensive. And again, harmful or offensive? Fact question. But you'll see, I mean, you can see that these are much more cut and dried in terms of proving your cause of action. Less likely, fewer defenses available, less likely to provide ways out for an intentional, a defendant has the requisite intent. Notice here, no issue of assumption of risk. The fact that she came after him, that she had a hand in all of this in Picard. No, we don't want, assumption of risk isn't a possibility. We don't have a risk when we've got an intentional tort. Then we talked about the Wisnowski case. Again, harmful or offensive contact to a person of ordinary sensitivities. Harmful of, or offensive to a person of ordinary sensitivities. Here, our plaintiff was admittedly sensitive. He said he had a high degree of sensitivity. He was, you know, claims to have been very, very upset by being shoved out the room. It's the fact that it wasn't, he wasn't touched, you know, he was shoved by the door was intermediary, you know, maybe even if he had been shoved. Question, was it harmful or offensive? No question of harm. He said he was offended. Court said it has to be offensive to a person of reasonable sensitivity. So, Restatement 18, harmful or offensive contact. 19 says offensive to a reasonable sense of personal dignity, not someone who's overly sensitive. So, question, your personal dignity, the court doesn't want to go looking at a whole bunch of, although we want to discourage antisocial behavior, we're not going to be questioning a whole bunch of subjective plaintiffs. You know, we had objectivity for our intent. We have objectivity for our causes of action too. The touching doesn't have to be violent; sufficient that it's offensive. Even though the battery was originally intended to deal with too much violence, sufficient that it be offensive, harmful, or offensive. Now, it's unconsented touching, harmful or offensive. We talked about medical procedures that are unconsented to. You get a shot. Are that Mink v. the University of Chicago, the DES administered. All harmful or offensive. When we talk about next class, we'll talk about privileges, implied consent. You're standing there. The doctor gets the needle ready. You're standing there with your arm out. You can't later say, oh, I didn't mean to get that shot. Implied consent that you were, you know, showed up during office hours and rolled up your sleeve. Again, there has for battery, neither harm nor offense would be enough without the bodily contact. Doesn't mean the body has to be touched, hair, clothes, camera, but there has to be some contact. If it's just a threat, limit to assault. You have to be the contact has to be there. You don't have to be aware of the contact when it happens. Remember, getting beaten up while you're passed out, the contact is still there. In terms of false imprisonment, the issue there is there has to be a confinement, and that, again, interested in freedom of movement, bodily, you know, not just bodily integrity, but your whole freedom from confinement. So there has to be a confinement that's not under a valid warrant, for example. So detention, confinement doesn't have to be physical, usually is, not necessarily, but usually is. Doesn't have to be physical restraint, that is, locked in a room, but confinement in that your freedom of movement is impinged upon. Confinement has to be unjustified or wrongful detention or confinement for false imprisonment. And the harm is the removal of your free will, the mental harm, if you will, caused by knowing you can't move around. And we talked about the issues because it's such a, as opposed to assault based on fear, battery based on touching, because this is moving away into a very indefinite kind of injury, mental distress at having your free will impinged upon. Court keeps definitely wants, is not willing to make any excuses, not willing to loosen it up a little bit. So Lopez V went to a donut house. Our employee was taken into a back room and interrogated. Clearly she was, there was a balance of power issue. Clearly, two against one. She was a young girl. She had no power whatsoever. The court said she wasn't really confined. She could have left when she wanted to, although the door was latched, and I'm sure they made a big point out of latching it. Said she could have gotten up, unlatched it, and left whenever she wanted to. So, no confinement here. I think the court was probably just saying, disapproving these kinds of suits, retaliatory against an employer who was going after self-help. And again, indeed, look at the New York statute that we mentioned that allows reasonable interrogation to get, for a retail establishment to get back property. It gives you immunity from any sorts of false imprisonment claims. So the restatement says fixed boundaries, complete confinement. There may be means of escape, but the confined person can't know about it. Again, can't know about it and can't be able to take advantage of it. Not too many false imprisonment cases, although I mentioned Charlie Sheen's latest date is now saying she's going to bring false imprisonment claims because she was locked in the bathroom apparently after he said claimed her that she stole his wallet. Sounds like a good time was had by all, and again she was certainly confined. The next thing we talked about was emotional distress. This is the least intentional infliction of emotional distress, the least definite of all of the intentional torts that we're studying. Very amorphous, very vague requirements. Restatement 46, extreme and outrageous conduct. We're just punishing people for extreme and outrageous conduct. That gives someone a pure dignitary tort. It just gives, acknowledges that people's dignity is important. And the requirements are extreme and outrageous conduct. Again, very, very vague definition, and the courts really want to make it extreme. The vagueness of the definition could lead to a lot of abuse. Courts recognize that and say it has to be extreme and outrageous. You see case after case that would lead a reasonable person to say that's outrageous. And we looked at some of the cases there. Sometimes it's just to punish people. You see, it's hard for me to see it under this McDermott v. Under the first case that we talked about, the Womack v. Eldridge. This photographer, because she lied, she got these photographs under false premise, false conditions. There, she lied about the whole thing. So, court says the jury could conclude that defendant willfully, recklessly, intentionally, and deceitfully obtained the photo because it was very fact-specific. It implicated our plaintiff in a child molestation case. The court says it could that a reasonable person would or should have recognized the likelihood of the serious mental distress that would be called. Remember, the reason I'm talking about reasonable person is they also say this is not just an intentional tort. It's reckless, too. It comes under intentional tort, but it's because it's intentional infliction of emotional distress. They say intentionally or recklessly acted extreme and outrageous. Again, the main elements of the prima facie case, extreme and outrageous conduct that causes severe emotional distress leaves wide discretion to the trier of fact. Has to go beyond malice. Goes beyond the decency set in a civilized society. So our McDermott v. Reynolds case, court says here you can't use intentional infliction of emotional distress when really the claim is alienation of affection, and the courts long ago dropped that cause of action. Statute long ago expired. So even though the plaintiff claimed that the source of the damages is from the emotional distress, not the wife flaunting their relationship, her extramarital relationship, the court disagreed. Says the statute was designed to abolish suits for a certain type of conduct. However you call that conduct, you can't disguise one cause of action by just calling it emotional distress. Often these cases arise in a relational context. Emotional distress cases from the repeated insulting calls, harassing calls from credit agencies happened all the time. Emotional distress from sexual harassment, racial harassment, or are better ways to protect this through statutes. Again, our question is the conduct itself has to be extreme and outrageous. Next class, we're going to start with Hustler v. Falwell, where the question is, when does extreme and outrageous conduct, what ordinarily might be extreme and outrageous, fall under the protections of the First Amendment? So Hustler v. Falwell, the case that brought up was the culmination of People v. Larry Flint. If you ever see that movie, this is the case behind that. So next class, we start with Hustler, and we'll finish up with all of the privileges for intentional torts.